This is Greater LA, KCRW show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Saul Gonzalez of KQED's The California Report, in for Steve Chiatakis.
Oh! Whoa! Right, Phoenix with that mule kick. Double super kick to the knees.
Wow! Oh, man.
Let's go see what's going on over here on Mission Street in South Pasadena. It's usually quiet and quaint. But tonight, inside a small store, a TV is showing two masked men in tights. It's the Lucha Brothers.
The Lucha Brothers!
And they're wrestling the Lucha Libre variety, a high-flying, colorful, comic booky style of wrestling popular in Mexico. This shop opened during the pandemic, when lots of other businesses were closing. Even more surprising, it's a big success, a go-to cultural destination. The store owners kind of can't believe it.
It's just insane that you would play like, oh, I'm going to show you this movie about two Mexican guys in tights and capes and masks fighting an army of little people dressed as werewolves and some bikini girls dancing in the background. It's going to be in Spanish.
That's Javier Robles, co-owner of the store, Republic of Lucha.
They come back next time and they bring the friend, and like the word of mouth we're getting is like, you have to see this place.
KCRW's Angel Carreras has the story on this mask and spandex space in the heart of South Pasadena.
Okay, so quick explainer if you want a little more on Lucha Libre. It's a Mexican born and bred style of wrestling characterized by colorful masks. It's steeped in tradition. It has these bigger than life characters that do death defying moves for the sheer enjoyment it brings others. A luchador embodies and performs Lucha Libre. Here's Ray Phoenix, who's a pro at this thing, and also the co-owner of South Pasadena's Republic of Lucha, with his take.
Here in other countries, they're very popular superheroes. It's Batman, it's Superman, all these superheroes. And in Mexico, we have real superheroes. Mil Máscaras, Santo, Blue Demon. People, can you go to watch and look, these guys, all the stuff can do. You can touch, you know, it's real.
Lucha Libre is real, and its impact with people from the richest snobs to the most humble people in Mexican culture love Lucha Libre. Like, that's a real, real element.
And that is Javier, who you heard from earlier. He runs a store with his wife, Ari de Alba, while the luchador owners are, you know, luchadoring. Together, they've created, you know, kind of like a wrestling dork's Disneyland. I mean, you walk in, on your right, you're greeted by floor-to-ceiling wallpaper of the luchador co-owners, Pinta El Cero and Rey Fénix. And to your left, there's a mini ring with life-size mannequins wearing the wrestler's in-ring garb, for sale, naturally. Wrestling matches perpetually play in the background. The cultural context of Lucha Libre plays a huge part in Republic of Lucha's appeal.
The store is not for... we're not focused on the sport. Mm-hmm. It's not a store for the fans of the sport. Like, yeah, come here every weekend and watch him kick his ass. And like, it's not about that. And if that's your concept, it's not going to work.
So what is the concept?
Within that sport comes out of this true, colorful, massive culture that has... the events, the music, the movies, the clothes, the masks.
On a Friday night, a surprisingly classy photography exhibit. A line of people are clamoring to get in. Famous Mexican photographer Lourdes Grobet is having a show. On one wall, there's a pic of Andre the Giant towering over two short wrestlers, or normal-sized wrestlers, I guess, compared to him. And then on the right wall, there's a picture of a luchador sipping soup with his mom, just to name a couple. And speaking of couples, David and Yvonne Quintanilla were having dinner across the street. They noticed a line, music, luchador stuff, moseyed on in. I asked what pulled them inside.
There's Latino, to tell you the truth, because this is South Pasadena, and it's like, South Pasadena is a ritzy neighborhood. It's not exactly East LA. So to see a Latino exhibit like this, particularly wrestling, which a lot of people look down on as being funny stuff, it's really neat to see.
Yvonne Quintanilla said she appreciated the artistry on display, even if she was scrunching her nose up at some of the more action-oriented shots.
I definitely I'm not into this sport. Yeah, it's not something that appeals to me. However, it's a humankind. So why not to learn something different?
Most Saturdays, Republic of Lucha hosts rooftop movie nights too.
It's one of the most classic Santo movies. It was filmed back in 1969. Back then, nudity was illegal, not taboo.
They've sold out almost every screening so far. And it's easy to see why. They show old-school luchador films that are hard to find and even harder to take seriously. Here's Robles introducing El Vampiro y el Sexo, which is kind of what it just sounds like. Stars El Santo, legendary luchador, by the way.
In Mexico, so some movies recorded an alternate nudie version for European markets, but those movies were lost because the families started blocking them and they were banned. So this movie we're going to have to see. It's actually banned in Mexico. Lucky for me, in Mexico right now.
So you can see why people want to get together for this now, especially having been through more than a year of a pandemic. But this place was getting foot traffic back in March when much of LA was in lockdown and this place just opened. That's because wrestling was exploding before the pandemic.
The wrestling community in LA, I don't know if people are aware of just how massive it is. The more premier wrestling-oriented shows, in Los Angeles, any of those shows, any day of the week, is always sold out. And aside from that, you have the 20 backyard shows on the weekends, like the quinceañera shows, the Mexican shows, from Stockton to Bakersfield to Riverside. Like, it's a huge thing. New Japan is having a show.
Robles and the two luchadores, whose own popularity was skyrocketing, wanted to capitalize on this.
So we started talking about getting an investment going between the three of us and just doing something different and creative in LA, because the market's so strong for Lucha Libre. A small shop in Boyle Heights or a taco truck, something very, very, something small.
But then, pandemic. So scrap the taco truck. They figured selling merch, masks, gloves, action figures, t-shirts, whatever, instead could help the wrestlers' bottom line and give the store a chance to show off lucha culture as well. So right away, they found this South Pasadena space with high ceilings, a rooftop, a window storefront, and lots of wall space.
Tragically, because of the pandemic, they gave us a really good deal for this space. So that thing that was going to happen 2 years from that conversation happened 2 weeks.
So they saw the store, decided to stretch the original concept, and the rest is lucha history. The first art show was a photo gallery from Audrey de Alba, a very talented photographer in her own right. And since then, it's been a wild success, especially with locals.
People were like, why South Pass? The foot traffic that we get here on this location, it's not the casual lucha fan, it's old white lady. We have a lot of little Asian children that come with their grandparents and they love it. There's no culture, there's no division. It's a really big part, not just of Mexican culture, but of Southern California culture and Los Angeles.
The spike and the end of the night, the Lucha Bros victorious.
The winners of this match,
the Lucha Brothers. TV's on, and Lucha Brothers get the win in the ring and outside of it because customers are filtering in and out, they're looking at the gloves, they're buying the masks, they're going to these movies, they're gaining this wrestling education, which is good because owners hope to one day add a wrestling school and a wrestling promotion to the list of things Republic of Lucha does. When they do, expect a crowd. So get in line now. For KCRW, I'm Angel Carreras.
You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Saul Gonzalez, in for Steve Chiatakis. Last week, Grant Elementary School in Hollywood sent an entire classroom home after a reported 7 COVID infections at the school. That's just one of a rising number of reported cases in Los Angeles Unified. There have also been outbreaks in extracurricular activities, like cheerleading and dance squads. Los Angeles County Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer says she anticipates, quote, an upward trend in outbreaks, now that schools have reopened to in-person instruction. Howard Bloom is education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He's covering the story, and he's here to update us on the latest, as well as to explain what happens at schools when there is a COVID outbreak. Hi, Howard.
Hi, how are you?
Good. So how many infections generally have we seen in the LA Unified or Los Angeles County schools since the academic year began?
Several thousand. Now, in LA Unified, in the first week of school, just to give you a sense of this, one in every 70 students was affected either by a positive test case or a quarantine because they were a close contact. So that's a lot of students when you're talking about some 450,000 students. And there were some places where there was very little effect at all. And then this, by the same token, there were some schools where there was a concentrated effect, because if you have one or two students testing positive, it could result in an entire class being sent home or multiple classes.
So can you walk us through what happens at a school when there is a confirmed case of COVID? And let's start with how parents are notified, for instance.
Well, LA Unified is a little different than some places, and we should probably get to that in a moment. But in LA Unified, students and staff had to take a baseline test before the start of school, and they had 2 weeks to do that. Now, that's not perfect, right? You could take a baseline test 2 weeks before school, and then 3 days later, you could get a COVID infection.
Right.
But testing is just one layer of safety, right? It doesn't depend entirely on the testing, but there is weekly testing. And if you come up with a positive result, you are notified of that, and you are supposed to isolate at home. Then the district has to go through the process of doing contact tracing. And if you were within a person who tested positive for 15 minutes, you know, close contact, 6 feet or less is generally considered that, over a 24-hour period, and it's cumulative. So 5 minutes here, 5 minutes there, that counts. And that can be really tricky to figure out if you're at a school. Think about that. But if they decide you're a close contact, then you have to quarantine at home. And if you've been vaccinated, you don't have to stay home. You can just test and check for symptoms. If you have not been vaccinated, which is anyone under 12 and many people over 12, then you do actually have to stay at home for at least 8 days. So that's basically how it works. Now, in other school systems, they don't do this regular testing. So if somebody doesn't have symptoms and the family isn't proactive in seeking out a test, they're not going to know about it until symptoms appear or a family reports it. So it's not as systematic as in LA Unified.
So let's say I'm a student at, you pick the school district, that's not LA Unified, Long Beach or Pasadena or Glendale, another big urban school district. What generally are they doing compared to the LA Unified?
Well, they're doing a lot as far as safety measures, and they think they are keeping their schools safe. But what they're not doing typically is testing all students every week. Now, Pasadena is definitely moving in that direction, but early on, they had a case that resulted in quarantines because a student was showing symptoms. The family took the student to a drugstore to get tested, and the scenario unfolded from there. And some parents in these districts are unhappy that their school systems aren't doing as much as LA Unified. Conversely, there are some parents in LA Unified who are worried that LA Unified is doing too much and that there are all these quarantines resulting that have disrupted education. In the first week alone in LA Unified, there were, we already said one in 70, but that works out to about 6,500 students who were at home in isolation or quarantine. And that was just the first week of school.
You know, I can't help but just think about the size of the LA Unified, right? It's the second largest school system in the country. Hundreds of thousands of students, thousands of more teachers and staff. I mean, it's like a big city. And can you just talk about the lift of testing that population of people regularly? And is it any kind of a drain on the school system?
It is a tremendous effort, and you have to give the district some credit for just coming up with this. I mean, there is a trade-off involved. Early on, they decided they would create their own testing system regardless of the cost, and it has been quite expensive. I've heard estimates of $350 million for the testing program this year, and it was $100 million by the district's estimate last year, when in fact it did not serve any purpose in opening schools earlier. Schools pretty much did not open until teachers and other school employees were vaccinated, and that was the driving factor. But it's a massive undertaking. They're plan is to test 500,000 individuals a week, so 100,000 every weekday. It took a few days to get up to that, but they say that is essentially what they're doing. Now, there's also a little bit of a time lag, so even with this testing, it can take 1 to 2 days to get the results back, and that can be a problem in some cases. They're also using some rapid antigen tests so that if somebody shows up and they haven't been tested, as long as they have parental permission, they can give them a quick test and get them in school. Because the rule is, unless you're tested, you're not going to school. And they are trying to come up with strategies to get people into school quickly.
And just returning this back to campuses, is there any talk of concern about particular COVID hotspots when it comes to grade level or when it comes to campus activity? We mentioned cheerleader squads, for instance, in the intro to our conversation. Any particular concerns there that are starting to emerge?
I think there are different concerns at every level. So the concern at elementary school, for example, is that nobody's vaccinated. You have a campus and 90% of the people on the campus are kids who cannot be vaccinated.
Sure.
And kids are often asymptomatic, but they can certainly still pass on the infection to others. They can take it home to vulnerable people. So that is a problem at that level. At the high school level, you have activities that are more likely to spread the virus, such as cheerleading, football, basketball, sports where there's close contact and heavy exercise. You also have students moving from class to class. So instead of having a self-contained class as at elementary school, you might have students moving into 8 classroom periods a day. And that makes that a challenge. And then you also have students who are not going back at all, who are doing their studies online. But there have been a lot of challenges getting these online programs up and running. So really, there are challenges at every level depending on the circumstances.
And just finally, to families listening to us talk, to parents listening to us talk, any advice for them, particularly people who are trying to strike an equilibrium between, you know, common sense caution on one side and totally freaking out on the other when it comes to COVID and safeguarding against COVID on campuses? Do you have anything to say to them?
One thing that experts have said is that you have to keep in mind the trade-offs here. It is possible to get sick and seriously ill from COVID, but it is also possible to suffer harms from not going to school in person. I mean, there are some families who cannot go back. They have a medically fragile student or a person at home, and they can't take the risk. But for most families, the experts seem to say it is best off for children to being in school. You can't eliminate all risk. There's no such thing as zero risk, but you can create a relatively safe environment, and you have to consider the risk of not going to school. And, you know, you do have to check on things and make sure your classroom and your district is following good safety protocols. Contact school board members. They answer, you know, they're elected officials, and they have to answer somewhat to constituents, sometimes more so than the district bureaucrats. So if you're not getting the answers you want, by all means, contact that school board member and be a little bit of a squeaky wheel.
All right. That is Howard Bloom, education reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Howard, thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Saul Gonzalez in for Steve Chiatakis. The Orange County Sheriff's Department received a report card of sorts last week. And let's just say the grades weren't good. Let's head to OC.
An investigation from a county oversight agency found glaring issues with the Orange County Sheriff's Department use of force policies and the way it trains new hires. Here to talk about it is Gustavo Arellano, a columnist at the Los Angeles Times and a regular contributor here at Greater LA. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Sal.
So let's first talk about something called the Office of Independent Review, or OIR, which is behind this investigation. What is that?
So it's an office that oversees the sheriff's department, district attorney's office, public defender's office, probation, basically the whole criminal justice industry in Orange County. And it's funny because I have to think about it when I have to try to describe it, because it's been toothless for decades. I mean, it's been around for a while, but the past two people, the people who headed it, they were too chummy with the sheriff's department. The current guy now, Sergio Perez, he's a newcomer. He's not from Orange County, but he's coming in. And from the bat, he said, like, I'm going to really get into it. And everyone laughed. Ha, 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 ha. Really? You're going to try to tell Orange County law enforcement they're doing wrong? And with it, this is the first report they've issued. And yeah, he's really going there.
Okay, let's dive into the report itself. It focuses primarily on issues related to poor training, unclear policies, and the late filing of use of force reports. Start with training. What did it find there, particularly when it comes to, say, new hires?
Well, you read this report, and it's business as usual for a sheriff's department. For an outsider's eyes, you're like, what on earth is happening? So the Office of Independent Review, they actually went through some of the trainings. And in one of the trainings, one of the instructors for, remember, these new hires is saying, oh, yeah, I know we have a manual talking about, like, use of force, but, you know, you don't really have to listen to too much of it. And then another person, this is all in the report, by the way, I'm not just making this up. Mm-hmm. Another instructor told his trainees, oh, yeah, back in my day, like, if we had to discipline an unruly prisoner, we would go to a part of the jail where there's no cameras and, you know, bend their fingers a little bit. This is what was seeing. And this is the training that newbies were getting in the sheriff's department, according to the Office of Independent Review report.
Right. The report also talks about how many policies regarding use of force are hazy. They're open to interpretation. They point to something called Policy 300. What is that?
It sounds like some Orwellian thing,
yeah.
Right? But it's supposed to deal with the use of authorized force. And this is one of the problems that the Office of Independent Review, or OIR, pointed at. It doesn't really spell out what exactly it is. For instance, it's unclear. A carotid restraint, in other words, like putting a chokehold on someone, which is outlawed by the state, according to the way you could read the manual in Orange County, it could be very well passable in Orange County. Another thing is, like, when to use a warning shot. Like, it doesn't really say that. And I mean, it's such hazy writing that possibly a deputy could use a weapon that is not approved if they find in their job that, well, if you use it and you're kind of justified to do it, then it's okay. So, you know, it's again, business as usual in Orange County, but for the rest of the civilized world, you're like, what on earth is going on here?
And there's also been troubles with just kind of filling out rudimentary paperwork, right? Like, if you're a sheriff and you use force in the course of your day, you're supposed to file a report when you clock out, but apparently that's not happening according to the report.
Yeah, this has been an ongoing issue under Don Barnes. We talked about it. Me and Steve Chiotakis talked about it. I don't think it was last year, maybe last year. But yeah, so the OIR, they found that this is an ongoing problem. They took a sample study, you know, a sample case of how many people were turning in the reports late. And so they estimated that 20 to 21% of all reports are being turned in late. In one case, a deputy turned in their report 41 days late. So again, this is a culture at the Orange County Sheriff's Department that tolerates these things for reasons known only to them. And OIR saying, like, you can't do this. This opens up the county to lawsuits, a lot of lawsuits and liabilities. And also, you're just not supposed to do it. You're law enforcement. You're supposed to be above reproach. And this is not it.
Okay. So if those are some of the problems in this report, what are the remedies that it's recommending?
No, you know, this is where I saw that. I'm like, they're just saying better training. Mm-hmm. There's no penalties involved
usual,
with this.
Usual.
In other words, Yeah, it's business as usual. But I mean, hopefully there'll be a follow-up to this. It's, you know, but even this, even just the fact that you have this report, this official rebuke by the OIR of law enforcement, it's something worth noting. And it's something pretty historic, because in the past you've had grand juries put this, nothing. You've had, of course, Scott Sanders, you know, a public defender has been talking about this for years. Nothing really happened. So this is a step, I guess, in the right direction.
All right, that is Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, a regular on Greater LA. Thanks so much, Gustavo.
Gracias.
And that's our show for today. Tomorrow, we know California needs more housing, and a bill moving through the state legislature seeks to create it by changing local zoning laws that protect single-family home properties. Not everyone is happy about it. We'll hear more about the bill and local concerns tomorrow. As always, you can check out the show anytime you want at kcrw.com/GreaterLA. You can also subscribe to the podcast and there and wherever you get your podcasts. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, Sue Margulies, Amy Ta, Christine Comito, Mike Vogel, and Christian Bordal all had a hand in our show today. This is Greater LA. I'm Saul Gonzalez. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk again tomorrow.